Morning. Thanks for having me back. Thank you, Sonia, for that lovely observation. What she didn't say is that I learn just enough about things to be entirely confused by them and then come here and share that with you. So, lucky you. Last time I was here, I was painting a fairly bleak picture of some things I was learning about artificial intelligence. I was sharing those with you to the point where people in the front were kind of pleading with me, please, please say something, even vaguely hopeful, please. I didn't bow to that pressure because I have my integrity, you know? I have my truths that need to be aired. But I did leave here thinking, all right, next time I come out, I'll try to look, you know, at things a bit differently. I'll try to be a bit more upbeat. A bit more uplifting. I'll try to look on the sunny side of life. That now, in light of today's topic, seems, as they say, a bit ironical. So hang in there with me, and if it's not me, I'm sure at least Brad will be back to lift your spirits. And to the Nederlands, goedemorgen, ma familie, kom uit de Nederlands. I have no idea who I'm talking to, but... it's nice to know that they're weighing in. If you have in the Netherlands some comments or suggestions about my references to the Netherlands as we talk about assisted suicide, medical aid in dying, et cetera, I hope you'll email me with that. So a little bit of jargon in this one, but I'll try to keep that to a minimum. And in terms of being uplifting and all that, it's one reason I did include the quote from Socrates. Because who knows that in the end, truly, literally and figuratively, who knows that death isn't perhaps the best state of all? And we don't. And he wanted to leave open that possibility. And for many living human beings among us, of course, that's what we're here to talk about today. For them, the end, how the end comes, choosing the end, whether it's on their own or physician-assisted, who knows? Perhaps they do, that the end might not be better than the continuation of the life that they're currently leading. So let me start with a couple things just to do this in class oftentimes. Just kind of take your own moral temperature. Just be aware of your response to these couple of cases or scenarios, if you like. Just see what you think. Because one of the things I want to do today is not so much go over old ground that probably a lot of you are familiar with. It's like, yeah, dignity, sanctity of life, all that stuff. But maybe look a little ahead to the future and what's happening, not just in the Netherlands and Canada, Germany as well, some of the states. So imagine I come up here. I'm 67. I've got an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. And what most people consider a pretty good job. Good life, lots of opportunities. But I say to you, you know, I am tired. I'm tired of living. And I think out of respect for my autonomy, my right to determine my future, I should be allowed to die. Now, that's a positive right, not a negative right. A positive right means somebody has to help me provide the means to that. They don't have to be push the button or inject me, but I do need probably someone to help assist with that. Would you have any objections at all? And this is rhetorical. I'm not opening it up just yet, folks. You'll have your chance. But just take your own temperature on this. Any objections to why an otherwise healthy, reasonably sane 67-year-old man with a family and a good job and lots of opportunities shouldn't be allowed to determine whether he lives or dies? If your initial response is, well, you've got some obligations still, financial, psychological, emotional, familial, boy, you've got this all this great stuff, you know, still to do, you've got a future still, you know, there's the net positive of staying alive seems so much greater. The philosophers call it the deprivation point of view. Helping to determine these questions, you kind of take a look and say, well, given everything we know, and can reasonably expect, is it likely that the net positive of your future states is going to be greater than the net negative? And that's one of the ways that they advise people on these kinds of issues. Well, it seems like the net positive for me is much bigger. Plus, if you're thinking, well, you know, you have, in terms of duties, you have a duty or an obligation, then you're not certainly an absolutist when it comes to the autonomy question. Because lots of folks in this audience, I'm guessing there's some of this, that the right to determination, the right to self-determination, the freedom that comes with that, the autonomy of being able to determine my life is what gives my life purpose and certainly gives it dignity. And if you're in the face of that, either from state legislation or tremendous pressure on me from local sources, then, you know, I can't exercise that autonomy. But this question, the way I posed it, really seems to call that into question for lots of people. And the reason I'm raising it is because in Germany and in parts of the Netherlands, this conversation is very much alive, and it will be alive more and more in Canada as well. And it's the question of an autonomy-only approach to assisted suicide, aid in dying. And I'll just make a short, quick working distinction we can use today, and that is euthanasia, normally understood as involving a hands-on approach from some medical person, usually a physician, but not always. Physician-assisted suicide or medical aid in dying could be both. Could be that there's a physician or somebody else from a medical field involved in helping you end your life. Or it could be you have the means, you're given the means, and you do it on your own. And a lot of people don't like assisted suicide anymore in this country. The Europeans are still a little more blunt than we are, as you know. People hear the medical aid in dying, assisted dying, suicide sounds, well, I would choose to live, you know, if my conditions were different, so I don't want to call it suicide. So those are some of the semantic questions that are up. But the autonomy-only position that the Germans and to some extent the Dutch are having, because what's happening in parts of the Netherlands is so interesting, to me at least, is it's this question of people in their late 70s, 80s, who are saying, I'm just tired. And I wish I could do it in Dutch. I don't remember it in Dutch, but it's like, I've lived a complete life. And the best research on this, it's a qualitative study going out to, for the most part, elderly Dutch people, and asking them, said, well, you know, I think I should have the right to terminate my life, even though I'm not suffering from irremediable suffering. I don't have a terminal illness, but I'm 79 or I'm 85 or whatever I am. My kids are gone. I've raised them. I can't get out. I can't do the kinds of things I used to like to do. I don't work anymore. There's a sense of purposelessness. There's a sense in which I'm just tired. My life is done. So could you, the state or the medical community, assist me in ending my life? And it's not legal in the Netherlands at this point, but it's a real conversation. And the Germans have taken it a step farther. There was a 2020 case in the German Federal Constitutional Court, and they're still working out how to actually apply this, and there's a lot of conversation back and forth, but they've gone a little bit farther, and I'll actually read you the wording of the court case because it's quite fascinating. They said, the right to a self-determined death as an expression of personal freedom is not limited to situations defined by external causes. The right to determine one's own life course is in particular not limited to serious or incurable illness, nor does it apply only in certain stages of life or illness. All right? And so that's a kind of highly rational, reasonable approach based on this principle of personality and self-determination that you find ensconced in most Enlightenment constitutions in the developed world. But let me go back to my case and present it to you again. I'm 67, not suffering from anything other than the normal things that somebody my age would be suffering from. And life is good, but I just decide, because I've got the right to self-determination, constitutionally ensconced, but philosophically, you know, sort of bolstered by everything from the Enlightenment tradition that, you know, sees individuals as more important than the community for the most part. And I come to you and I say, I think I should be allowed to terminate my life right now. In principle, where the Germans are heading in terms of this constitutional case is, there's no objective stance that all of you could take. There's lots of arguments you could give me. You know, you might think I'm psychologically, you know, off. They might think all kinds of things are wrong with me. But in no way should that override my ability to self-determine as long as I can meet the following criteria, which I will read to you now if I can find it. It's a decision-making tree. I will find it. Decision-making capacities, okay? So no serious illness, no overriding pain and suffering, just self-determination. And again, I raise this, and I'm taking this particular tack because I think this is the way it's going. As more communities, states, countries, provinces around the world put into law the possibility of ending one's life, they do it largely under the principle of beneficence, right? There's an awful lot of suffering going on. And by the way, I have Dr. John Mulder's voice in my head whenever I hear suffering. And he was here about a year ago or so with me, and we had this conversation. And I could see, even when this issue came up, and John was a firm believer in we can manage any pain that you've got. And, you know, he was, to the end, against the notion of assisted suicide for what it would do for the medical community, as well as just an individual and their family's ability to go through this process, dying process, together. And so I got John's voice in my head saying, you know, we can manage the pain. But, and this was part of my argument with him, and it's well, you know, well vetted in the literature, as you all know, pain is not just physical suffering. And in all the research that's done, physicians, perhaps excluding some of the physicians in the room who are obviously enlightened folks by mere fact that they're here, nonetheless, physicians in the research tend to give weight, in fact, oftentimes much more weight to physical symptoms and pain than they do to emotional, spiritual, existential questions. Doesn't seem to be their purview. So by suffering and pain, we're bringing all of the possible suffering that comes to bear in life, existential, emotional, psychological, not just physical. And even the physical pain, and I believe my friends who are physicians that most of that can be managed, but A, the memo doesn't always go out to everybody. There are gaps in some people's pain management, and I'll be personal here for a second. Apologize for this, sorry. But so I had a kidney stone about a month ago. And still to this day, it's astounding to me that women don't understand that kidney stones for men are far more painful than labor. I don't know. Still, I don't know why that argument persists. I don't get it. Anyways, I might be wrong about that. But my lovely wife was taking me to the hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, and I might have said something like, you know, I would like to die. I didn't actually, everybody understands, I didn't actually want to die. I didn't want to go, you know, and have Corwell Health put me down in the emergency room. I wanted, you know, the pain management, obviously, that's very good and that's there and that can remediate an awful lot of suffering. But when I was on the pain medication, there's also that question of, do I want to live, if I were to live like that in an extended state, right, for days, for weeks, for months, on a pain pump of some kind or other pain medication, and the resulting sort of foggy, vague state, whether it's accompanied by nausea or many of the symptoms that come with that, is that a quality of life that I would want as well? So I'll switch the case up now and just see if your internal response to this is at all different. So now I'm 85, right? And the kids who once loved me never come around, you know. never see them. And, you know, my darling wife has, you know, look, I'm 85. I mean, just not quite the attractive person that maybe I once was. So, anyway, there's a kind of growing isolation. I'm a little foggier. I can't do an awful lot of what I wanted to do. Life seems, in the Dutch, you know, framing of this, it seems complete. Whether I'm tired of it or it's just finished, and I have a strong subjective sense that it's finished. And here are the decision-making capacities that are in play in any number of end of life and decisions, significant decisions. You are allowed to take this course, DeWild, if you understand all the relevant information. So whether I'm 67 or 85, the Germans and the Dutch are coming to me and saying, do you understand exactly what's going to happen? Do you understand the implications of what you're asking for? Can you repeat that, and can you make sense out of it in some coherent way? Do I appreciate the significance of this information for my own situation? Can I weigh the risks and the benefits of that decision? Well, I've probably done some of that at least already if I'm at that point, but it's helpful, yeah, to sit down with, whether it's a physician, lawyer, counselor, best friend, here are all the things that I should be thinking about in this case. And can I make and communicate a choice? And where this is going for the folks who are the autonomy-only people, which takes the medicine out of it altogether, is that even if you're in a lockdown state, right, somehow communicate with your eye movement, right? However, because this is the big sticking point for an awful lot of folks, which is, well, what about the folks who are incapacitated in some way? Well, A, have your directive in place. B, tell people what you want. And C, as much as possible on the road to be able to communicate these particular desires, both again, in writing, or if you've developed some other communication system outside of writing speaking, to be able to communicate that. If I can do all those things, then the decision makers, the folks making decisions with me or providing assistance, are supposed to go along with my decision on this autonomy only. Here's where the Dutch have some empirical evidence that should give maybe all of us some pause about this. Well, two things. And one is not solely related to the Dutch. This is kind of a strong counter-argument all the way around. But in terms of this particular decision-making tree, here's what they've actually found among Dutch physicians when they try to make decisions about whether this person should go ahead with physician-assisted suicide. They may not be able to reliably identify who has the decision-making capacities. In 66 Dutch cases of assisted suicide, 55% of those cases, only global judgments of capacity were made. Only 8% mentioned all four of those capabilities or capacities. Physicians also appeared to rely on the presence or absence of clinical symptoms as evidence for or against capacity. This happened again in Belgium and Luxembourg, where more or less the same rules are in place. In other words, what happened, what they're seeing is, yes, that makes a lot of sense. Yes, we should grant that autonomy. In principle, all of this seems to uphold the dignity and self-determination of a person. That's good. What happens in practice is, if the physicians are themselves tired, exhausted, have prior existing commitments to maybe, you know, an advocacy for assisted suicide, or they just had never been trained in the decision-making tree in this case, confirmation bias, blind spots, you name it, over half of them aren't going anywhere near all these criteria. They're just saying, okay. And in terms of what's, you know, the outcome of this, not directly tied to all of the Dutch physicians. This was only 66 cases, and you're talking of thousands of cases every year in the Netherlands. But since 2002, when the Dutch legalized this, you're looking at about 5.4%, give or take, of deaths in the Netherlands attributed now to assisted suicide. And of those, most folks fall into the 70s and 80s, and most, certainly not all, but most of those are actually tied to cancer. The Dutch, for the most part, as I'm reading this, are saying, we think this is a system that's working pretty well despite some of its flaws, and now is the time to think about potentially expanding it. Same thing in Canada since 2016, and initially in Canada, the legislation was supposed to include people with mental illnesses. There was so much back and forth about, well, can those people, depending upon what they were diagnosed with, actually fulfill these decision-making criteria as well? We're not sure. They've pushed it out to 2027. Even so, in Canada, they're about at 4.8% of deaths in Canada, overall number of deaths in Canada, now being attributed to assisted suicide, or in their case, assisted suicide and euthanasia. Okay. If the beneficence model were doing this largely to end suffering, is the one we used. The counter argument, one of the strongest present counter arguments to that, is a notion of, well, the problem with that is that once you start to pick out categories of people, or maybe categories of people emerge who want this, you start painting with broad brush. In other words, well, you've got stage 4X kind of cancer. You know, 89% of people in your situation choose assisted suicide. Or you've got X kind of psychosis or depressive episodes that last more than 2 decades. I mean, name your ailment. The folks who are most concerned about this aren't so much arguing from the old sanctity of life point of view. They're more arguing from, look, we're going to find ourselves in a slippery slope situation in which whole categories are going to be painted with this broad brush, and it's going to be very tough for people to argue individually on their own not to be euthanized or to, you know, be strongly suggested to avail themselves of assisted suicide. And the counter-argument, of course, is no, we won't do that. That's the whole point of making this autonomy-based, is that we will, you know, respect everybody's individual decision. But if the Dutch study shows anything, it shows that we're still human. The people making these decisions are going to have biases and blind spots of their own. And the worry is, you know, how many people do we end up putting into certain categories where we make a judgment that say your life is inferior, your life is not worth living, right? And how far is it from there to a leap, which a number of utilitarians have already gone to, and you could even use the British system as one way of sort of tacitly saying this, that it's not that your life isn't worth living, it's that your life isn't worth us, the national healthcare system, putting X amount of money in to continue, right? Which is a kind of de facto or implicit sense of we're no longer going to support people who fall into certain categories. So overall, I find myself largely persuaded by the group of people, the camps, that want to argue for as much autonomy as possible with a dash of beneficence, understanding of suffering as broadly as possible, not just physical pain. And because I was raised in a rights-based culture and sort of drank the Kool-Aid around, you know, the Enlightenment of the last 300 years, you know, I also want to have that kind of determination to go ahead and make the call. But I also want to be sympathetic as Germany and the Netherlands and Canada lead the way on this, to what are the pitfalls? You know, are there people falling into certain kinds of cracks? Are there people feeling unduly pressured? Now, this is where your own, again, moral sensibilities would come in. If you're sort of just classic utilitarian, you would say, well, you know, there are going to be a few folks who suffer, who get caught up in this web along the way. You know, the handful of those, the 1% to 2%, that's the price we pay for, you know, granting this kind of self-determination to everybody else. If you're more of a duty or rights-based person, you would say, well, wait a minute, that one person could be me or my grandfather or somebody I'd rather not find in that situation. And so the arguments go back and forth. One of the things that's, I think, kind of revolutionary about what the German Supreme Court the Constitutional Court is suggesting, though, is we can take the medical side. Sorry? We can take the medical side out of this altogether. And you could imagine, on the principle of autonomy only and self-determination, finding yourself in a society where anybody has the right to determine what their own meaning, purpose, end-of-life situation is, acting on that, bypassing the medical establishment and going to some sanctioned place where you could buy the sodium, you know, barbiturate, so, I don't know, you know what I mean, the one that you take to help you end your life. Okay, in America, in the States right now, only a couple, you know, handful of places where this is going. The medical aid, the Death with Dignity Act in Michigan was sort of just didn't go anywhere. As of 2004, there's still a movement to try to get it back in front of the legislature, but at the moment, it's dormant. I'll end with the Amy Bloom because all of this is kind of, well, it's legislative and it's policy, it's high level, it's generalities. Amy Bloom wrote this, some of you may know her, wrote this wonderful book called In Love, a memoir of love and loss about her husband, Brian. There was this big guy, Yale football player, well-regarded architect, diagnosed with Alzheimer's in his 60s and decided pretty quickly, not for me. I'm not dragging you all down with this. I don't want to live in that state. Some conversation this morning about, you know, the people who do, the people who don't, people change their minds. Maybe I'm saying this morning is, would it be nice to have kind of a broad an umbrella as possible within which to make those decisions? A kind of erring on the side of the rights of the people, if you like. She, in the book, talks more about her own journey coming to acceptance to this. She was really resistant and spends half the book weeping, more than half. I think Mandy would say that if you're going to pick up the book, you should probably have at least a couple of boxes of tissues handy. You'll be crying by page 7. or so, and then all the way through the book. It's a, you know, she's got a wonderful eye for this. They end up going, it's a heroic process to try to get accepted as an American to Dignitas, which is a not-for-profit in Switzerland that helps people end their life peacefully and painlessly. And I'll just read you in closing, it's probably not fair to do this, but the last part of it. So she takes you through 200-some pages of her journey with him, with lawyers, with psychiatrists, with everybody, and she just this rants about the American, you know, healthcare system that becomes a rant about American society, that becomes a rant about anything and everything American. But, you know, it's very cathartic in that way. It feels great. They finally do get acceptance into Dignitas, and she's this beautiful, sort of heartbreaking passage about their last night together in Zurich, and they go to this fine restaurant, and just their, you know, reminiscences of their life together. Though he's also at a point in his Alzheimer's journey, where he's talking mostly about his football days rather than sort of how lovely it was to be with her. So she does have a moment where she chastises herself for feeling like, you know, would you shut up about football? But this is near the end, and here's he's in the room in at Dignitas, and she's observing. He takes the antiemetic again, and the ladies, the assistants, put an airplane pillow around his neck. Brian falls silent, and now I long for the football stories. I take both of his hands, and he lets me. I love you, I love you, I love you, I say, I love you so much. He says it too. He drinks the sodium pentobarbital. I kiss him all over his handsome, weary face, and he lets me. It's impossible to think about the next 20 minutes. I keep my eyes and hands on him as if I'll forget what it's like to breathe next to him or feel his presence. And then she says in parentheses, I don't, not for a minute. I hear his breathing when I go to sleep, and I feel his body heat when I wake up. He falls asleep, holding my hand, and his head falls back a little on the neck pillow. His breathing changes, and it's the last time I will hear him sleeping, breathing deeply and steadily, the way he has done lying beside me for almost 15 years. I hold his hand. I can still feel its weight and warmth. His skin color changes from ruddy to paler pink. I sit there and sit there as if some other thing will now happen. He's quite pale, and I see that he's gone from this world. I sit holding his hand for a long time. I get up and wrap my arms around him and kiss his forehead as if he is my baby, at last gone to sleep, as if he is my brave boy going on for a long journey, miles and miles of naught. So I wanted to end with that because there's the there's all the policy, there's all the legislation, there's all the work that needs to be done, no matter what side you're on this particular issue, in terms of giving all of us a dignified or a good death. And then there is the moment and the personal and the intimate itself, and there's no better book I've read than this one that describes that. I recommend it to you. The last thing I recommend it to you, and I know this is probably preaching to the choir in terms of this audience, but if you do not have an advance directive, if you have not talked to the people closest to you, the greatest moral injury I see in my consulting work at the hospital, physicians and nurses who find themselves absolutely caught between what they think the patient's wishes are and the family that swoops in with 1,000 different opinions. And if you, to the extent that you can have that now, consistently and clearly, the better it will be for all of us. So, thank you.